I'm Sue Holderness, and welcome to All Stations, the new podcast from the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. This series is about overcoming adversity. In today's episode, we meet World War II fighter ace and Battle of Malta veteran Alan Scott, one of the fund's charity ambassadors. Alan has supported the fund for years, playing a key role in raising awareness of our cause and helping us to find other elderly veterans who need our help and support. I've come to meet him at his home in Oxfordshire. Well, I'm here with Alan Scott, and I feel very privileged and happy and honoured to be allowed to chat to him about his life. I'm here because I have an RAF background. My father and two of his brothers fought from the beginning to the end of the war for the RAF, one in fighter, one in bomber, and one in coastal command, and they all survived. It's an extraordinary story, but not as extraordinary as Alan Scott's. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Now, Alan, how old were you when you first joined the RAF?
18.
And was that in 1939?
No, that was early 1940.
Oh, because you were... So you were a baby, weren't you?
Well, 18 is quite a good age. Your bags of adrenaline and excitement about being young.
And how long did it take to train to get you up in the air, actually fighting?
I was in the squadron again in early 1941.
How many hours flying did a pilot generally have in order to be able to actually go out and fight the enemy?
Roughly, we went about 50 hours, and then you were in flying a Spitfire or a Hurricane.
I can't believe it, only 50 hours.
Yes.
Well, from all I've heard, you were a natural. You're a gifted pilot, obviously.
Fortunately, I have to admit that. I don't like boasting, but yes, I had the skill in my hands, and it saved my life so many times.
One of my uncles, Hardy, I think, he said it was a bit like having a good seat on a horse. If you could really fly an aeroplane, it was just you felt as though the whole thing was strapped to your bottom and you could just feel it.
That's right. Well, the Spitfire was like that. It became an overcoat to you.
Yes.
And I flew instinctively. I didn't have to think about flying. If I turned my head, the aircraft would turn with me, sort of thing. And in combat, that was very useful because you have to, A, look at the your comrades so you don't collide with them, because the air is full of twirling aircraft on a combat. You're taking the bomber that you're shooting down. You can only stay 3 seconds on it before you have to turn or look for a Messerschmitt that's coming down out of the sun. And if you don't see him, he'll shoot you down as well. So the whole thing is really sort of go and...
So you were blessed by having very quick reactions.
Yes, thank goodness for that. I still have it.
I know, I've seen that. We've just been blessed that we've had lunch together. And you are speedy.
Yes.
You're speedy and you've got this wonderful motor scooter that I know you only use because you want to get around quickly. And you're whipping around in that. And indeed in your Mercedes. So tell me, when this was one of the things I could never persuade my family to talk about. What it's hard for us in this generation to understand is how you coped with the fear.
Well, you didn't realise. You were afraid, there's no doubt about it. People have often asked me this, were you afraid? Of course we were. But nature had a wonderful way of hiding it from you. Have you heard of the cold sweat?
Oh, yes.
Well, when you're in combat, you sweat. And the sweat comes down their face and it trickled into my mouth, and it's salty, by the way. And you think that the cold sweat is fear, and it's coming out in that way that you don't notice because your adrenaline is flowing and you're in real combat, you know. But I enjoyed the war, I must admit. It was a good family life, although our life expectancy was good and we realised this, although you never thought about it. When I got airborne, I never thought that I would not come back. And I was lucky, wasn't I?
So, Alan, you must have been only a boy when you shot down your first enemy aircraft.
Oh, I was. I was only 19, but I was under a leader of an ace in those days, as Robert Stanford Tuck. He was he'd got about 30 aircraft destroyers, so he was giving me the opportunity to follow him and learn. Again, in those days, you didn't see your if they reported 12 plus or 40 plus, you'd look and didn't see a thing. But by keeping close and flying operationally, it eventually came that you could see them. Now, the first aircraft I flew, I shot down, was a Junkers 88, which was trying to escape over Clacton-on-Sea. I remember that distinctly. And the crew bailed out, so I was quite happy about that.
Well done, you. And you were 19.
I was 19 years of age, yes. Full of adrenaline, full of excitement, and thought it was great.
And skill. Well, yes, and you and that seems to be the thing that perhaps has helped you, that you weren't then haunted by fear or anything. You just were doing the job and excited by it.
That's right. Yes, yes, quite. I think if you thought about it or thought about people being killed and you're missing your jobs, you'd never get airborne yourself. You've got to get airborne immediately. So you're not going to dwell on the fact that, oh, maybe me next time, you know. You don't think about that. You're doing a job and you get on with it.
It's a bit like falling off a horse. You get fall off the horse, get straight back on it.
That's right, straight back again. And that's what I did with the aircraft. If I had a crash, which when I was testing, you got straight back into the cockpit to get back into flying.
You are a brave man.
No, not really.
What was your favourite aeroplane?
Oh, the Spitfire, by all means, because it saved my life so many times.
So, Alan, tell me, what was the fiercest period of fighting that you experienced during the Second World War?
In Malta, of course.
Oh, Malta, yes.
Yes, because Malta, they only had a small island the size of the Isle of Wight to bomb, and it became the most bombed place on Earth, by the way, because they sent out hundreds and hundreds of bombers and flattened it. And we Spitfires were the only sort of opposition they had. And although we clobbered quite a few, it didn't stop them, did it? And sometimes we went down to only four, I'm talking about my squadron now, four Spitfires available because of serviceability. And we got airborne with four aircraft. And we had a little ruse, but they used to listen into the RT, of course. And so we thought, right, well, we'll call each other squadrons. So we sort of say, white leader, can you see that 40 plus? Yes, he's come back. Got that down. Green leader, can you? And so we made all four of us different squadrons by just saying we were leaders, you see.
So clever to fox the enemy.
They heard it and passed on to the enemy that there were four squadrons.
Four squadrons, and there were actually four planes.
Yeah, and actually four planes.
And didn't you say earlier, I think you told me, that you would scramble four times a day?
Sometimes, yes. Not always, of course. But yes, we often got scrambled four times a day.
And you were not very well fed.
We were starved. Not well fed. We were starved, actually. We lived on ship's biscuits. And if you know what a ship's biscuit is, it's
rather a hard thing, isn't it?
You break your teeth on them. They're so hard. But the cook used to put them in a pail of water and make a pudding. You know, the food was very scarce. And
you lost weight.
Oh, I lost 4 stone.
With very little sleep and very little food.
That's right.
And wasn't it very hot?
Very hot. We stayed under the wing of this aircraft to get out of the sun. There's a picture used the cockpit, got ready with all the straps ready when the parachute run from under the wing. If there was a scramble, we could go around the corner straight into the aircraft and be airborne within 4 minutes. So, and then you climb like mad to get above the bombers, but you never got above the measurements. They were always in the sun high.
So scary when you see that Messerschmitt coming at you.
Well, as long as you saw it, it's the Messerschmitt you didn't see that shot you down. Now, to shoot down an aircraft that's going at 200 to 300 miles an hour, one has to use deflection. And so, therefore, I was very glad to have a good sight and quick reactions to see the enemy coming down and turn into it and get away from him. And now they say in all the aces of Malta, I'm the last surviving ace from the Battle of Malta now. Of course, I'm getting on a bit. I'm 98 years of age.
You must have lost very many of your comrades.
Oh, yes. Yes, there's four squadrons at Malta, and we lost 36 in 1 week.
Terrifying.
I'm afraid during the war you got rather callous. You had to be callous because we all had a life expectancy of about 20 minutes, and you're all in the same boat. You could go up and you could be shot down. So when you came down, you had to be a bit callous about it. You couldn't think about dying, or otherwise you'd never get airborne again. So you used to come in and say, oh, where's Jock? Oh, he got shot down. Oh, that's it. But that was just part of life. You accepted death as such, that you could be the next one. Or on the other hand, I always thought that I wouldn't be. I always thought, no, I'm going to survive.
And I suppose it's this that has kept that kept you going from the beginning to the end of the war. You went into the war as a very fit young man with good reactions.
That's quite true.
And this natural skill with an aeroplane.
That again, I don't like to boast, but it's important that that skill did bring me through.
Saved your life.
Right through the war, yes.
So how old were you when you last flew a Spitfire?
Well, I flew it just a short while ago, 96.
And I believe you're planning to fly one when you're 100.
I am down to fly it at 100 from Biggin Hill, yes.
I'm coming to watch. But you must have had some very close friendships during that time.
Yes, I did. And you lose them, of course. And I only lost Johnny Mayer was my real friend. We flew together and looked after each other, he only died 2 years ago now. He died of dementia, Alzheimer's. And it was a pity to see him because we were full of life,
Yes.
And amazing, really. But Johnny Mayer, I still talk to his daughter.
Oh, that's nice.
Keep in contact and she gets in touch with me.
So, Alan, did you have in your career any crashes?
Oh, yes. The main one, the one that was the important one, the one that made me write the book To Survive, because I did survive. I was giving an air display to the boys of Fettes College in Edinburgh. I was flying from RAF Turnhurst, which is the Edinburgh airport, of course, and right next to a golf course. The Tiger Moth I was flying, a wonderful aircraft for aerobatics, and that's why I picked it, just to give the boys a sort of a thrill. I did what I do is my combat landing, which I shouldn't have done really, because that's the one I made up what I used to in Malta to get a sidestep landing so that I'd miss the strapping of aircraft. Anyway, I did a sidestep with this Tiger Moth from about 1,000 feet down to 500 or less. And instead of landing, which I normally did after a sidestep, I climbed away again. I opened up and only got to about 500 feet when my controls jammed. Mm. And I thought, well, and it was in no way could I undo, push and pull and everything. No, they were jammed. And my rudder was inoperative. So I thought, and by the way, I was starting to go down towards the ground. And I thought, well, now this is it. I don't know whether I'm going to survive this lot, but I think this is the one that's going to really end my career here and then, because knowing that it was going to go straight into the ground was no fun.
No, it doesn't sound good.
I remember saying to myself, I don't want to go in and catch fire because you burn, and I don't want that. So I remember switching off the engines and I went in with a dead prop. Now, from then onwards, I can't say what I remember because amnesia takes over from the crash. Mm. Only can only report what people tell me what happened after that.
Yes.
And apparently what happened after that is that I did go straight into the ground from their private fleet, but were strapped into an aircraft the same as you strap into the car to stop it hitting the windscreen. You're strapped into an aeroplane called Sutton Harness. And it's very, very tough indeed. And anyway, that was holding me in, of course. Now, how can I explain this? It was only the people afterwards that asked me, how did I cut my straps? And I said, you must be joking. I'm going down towards the ground at 500 feet and I'm calmly cutting straps. I said, ridiculous. I said, he said, well, all those four straps around your body were cut cleanly. And he said, it saved your life because the engine took your place and you went out, catapulted out of the Tiger Moth. But unfortunately, I hit my face and arm and everything on the upper structure, which took my face away. And I was in a bad way that way. But I was alive, and I landed on my head again. It's a good job. I was a good rugby player.
Did they ever explain how those straps got cut?
No, because they said, how did you, you know, I said, well, it's my guardian angel. And this is where it came in. I said, it must have been my guardian angel because he's looked after me all through the war and something, supernatural powers of, well, how can we explain? It's unexplainable. But they saved my life and they were cut. And it's just amazing.
Is the guardian angel with you still?
I think so. I always think it was my father, Dad. He was a wonderful man, very kind and caring. And we had a wonderful family, both Mum and Dad. And I had two brothers as well. I lost my sister in the flu epidemic, my twin sister. I was a twin. But the rest of our family was very close indeed. We all loved one another. And I always thought that Dad was my guardian angel, as well as the good Lord, of course.
Yes, well, I think that's a lovely story. I think your guardian angel is still with you.
I'm sure he is.
Because you're bright as a button. No, I think your dad's up there on that cloud. He's yeah. with you.
Yeah.
Oh, and Alan, this is your wonderful logbook with that beautiful brown cover and gold writing. And what's this first picture here?
Now, this is a picture of Biggin Hill, part of the squadron, the whole one. And I'm only 18 there, as you can see.
Look at you, little baby face.
Yes.
You were a good
looking... Well, I was.
You were a gorgeous-looking chap. And, still are.
Eh? No, no, not at all. I wish I was. Anyway, it was an international squadron, I'll tell you about that, because there were so many different things. Kuhl was a Czech. Bob Larcher was a Free French. Bertie the Belgian. English. MacReed was English. No, that's Tommy Monfort. Mike Ducorley was English. There's a Canadian, and myself, and a Pole. Then going to the front row, there's a Belgian, Australian. He's got the dark blue hat, as you can see.
This is really multinational.
Yeah. Norwegian, and he's Norwegian here. Bertie the Belgian, Bob the Free French, Czech. Myself, again.
They're all jolly nice-looking chaps, and they all look very young.
Well, we were.
You were all young.
We're all pretty young, yes.
And we don't know how many of these chaps still are around.
Well, I've got to shoot down. Kuhl, I've got my glasses on, sir.
Kuhl and Penny and Mike lost.
They are. There's three that lost after that, are there not?
It's so sad, isn't it? And yet somehow you had to learn to come to terms with this, didn't you?
Oh, you just accepted it. Yes.
Knowing that it could be your turn next.
That's right.
And still you went
up. And that's
why
we're all of equal status, because you think, I'm next, so why worry? Live while you can.
Yes, live every minute.
That's right.
For what it's worth. That's a beautiful picture.
That's a spit again.
Nice spit.
Let's see if I can get another. Oh, here we are. There's a measurement shot down. And you put it in the book every time you shot down that aircraft. And there is a picture of me actually shaking hands with the King. I was a sergeant pilot in those early days. That's from Biggin Hill. The King used to come to Biggin Hill. He was a wonderful king, George VI, wonderful. He was so good. He had a, he just welcomed you and you felt good. You felt it was worth going airborne.
You can tell that this book is very old from the colour of the pages, this rather wonderful yellow colour. How old is the book?
Well, it's about 80 years, isn't it? Because that's when I first...
You must have got it in 1939.
No, early 1940.
Early 1940, of course, because you didn't join right at the beginning because of your age.
That's right.
And you did you keep this going after the war?
Oh, yes.
When you went, when you stayed with the RAF?
Oh, yes, because here we are, these are all test pilots.
Oh, God.
Air test.
It's so neat, the writing in this book. It's fantastic. And so you actually have a record in this book of every single flight you've ever done.
I was thinking, look, there you are, air tests.
Crikey, look at this. Vampire, Mosquito, Hornet, Wellington, Devon.
My tallies of aircraft sort of built up and I flew almost... four different kinds every time, and they went up to Nelios 100 different times of aircraft. And of course, the when you're testing, it's you can fly four engines, the three engine. I must admit, I flew a Junkers 52 purely because it was in the hangar and I wanted to fly it. But that's a three engine, two engines, one engine, and so on. And then helicopters. That was a another quite different thing altogether. But all these aircraft I flew, I thoroughly enjoyed and found that I could fly them all without any trouble at all. Again, I seem to like danger somehow. The adrenaline used to flow, and I've always been that kind of person, and I came danger, and testing gave me that danger, and I enjoyed that as well. Oh, there's a picture of the crash and the of the tailplane that fell over under there.
Yes, the picture of that aeroplane with its nose in the ground is not good, is it?
Well,
it's a terribly good picture, but
I got away with
it. It's awfully good thing you were thrown clear. No, that I mean, you were so lucky to survive that, weren't you?
Yes, as you can see, it went straight in, and I was.
Over
the wing there, but I caught my face on the top wing.
Oh, it was on the wing that you got your face? And
The top one, the petrol.
How long did it take? Because you'd never know now that anything was wrong with your face.
No, all the stitches were put in the head.
So clever.
And this is a new nose. There's nothing in it. It's just a new nose, new cheeks and a new mouth.
Incredible, isn't it?
Yes, and that was a long time ago. That was, when I was 30, so that's 60 years ago.
And so your aeroplanes stayed in your life in one form or another until you were, what, about 55?
Yes, I came out of the Air Force at 55. That's quite true.
And was that a relief or did you miss the aeroplanes?
Oh, I missed the Air Force completely because the Air Force to me was a family and everybody was so friendly and we're all the same. And when we're in combat, it didn't matter what rank you were. You could be a top thing, but we're all the same. Sergeant pilots and going into civil life was rather an experience for me because I find that the civil life was different. They had no integrity that we had in the service. In the service, if you said you would do something, you would do it without any hesitation. And you had no worries about, as a CO, if I told people to do things, then I expected them to do it, and they did do it. We didn't have any trouble. But in civil life, that was quite different. They could, perhaps, or maybe, or things like that. Now, the integrity of life then was so difficult, and I had quite a time to adjust my thoughts to become a civilian.
We know that there are a lot of people out there who actually do need help. They would they would benefit greatly from the help and support, the money, the comfort that the RAF Benevolent Fund can give. And so we're trying to spread the word, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
That
yes.
Help is there, and we just want to say you mustn't be too proud to ask, because some people pride stops them.
They don't
them.
Even know about it. Some of them don't even know.
An awful lot of people simply don't know that the help is there.
That's true.
So thank you very much for helping us spread the word. Because
it's a pleasure. It always has been. I'm glad that I'm still able to do it and still will do it. I ask me to do something and I do it. It's great fun.
It is fun. fun, isn't it? And I know you've given wonderful and inspiring talks to school children.
Yes, I've done spoken to schools. I like speaking to the children because they ask so wonderful questions.
What's an example of a question you get asked by a young child?
One child just put her hand up. It was a girl, actually. And she said, had I met Mr. Hitler? And I said, no, thank goodness I didn't.
No, well, you must be able to bring it all to life for them.
Well, I hope so. Well, that's the idea of it.
I think you are an inspiration to us all, Alan.
Oh, I hope so.
Well, Alan, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. It really has.
Right, do you think you can give me a lift to the station now, Alan? Can we whiz off in your little Merc?
Of course.
Let's do it.
I'm delighted to take you. Sue, over here.
Is that you, Alan? In that sports car?
Yes, jump in.
Jump in? Yes, let's go for a little spin. Oh, Alan, this is thrilling. Let's go.
Let's get it more thrilling, everybody.
Oh, Alan, you're not going to go too fast, are you?
No, chocks away, and away we go.
That was really rather thrilling. I wasn't expecting a 98-year-old veteran to whisk me off in his Mercedes two-seater Sporter down a local pub. And we didn't go slowly. He is extraordinary, Alan, and I'm here today with another extraordinary chap, David Murray. He's the chief executive of the RAF Benevolent Fund, who has many stories of his own. And I'm here to find out a little bit more about the fund and what it could offer. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
And you are an RAF man yourself, aren't you? You've got a RAF history.
Yes, I served for 34 years. I joined up when I was 19, and having failed my A-levels, needed to do something with my life. So I joined up and to see the world. I joined up, I thought, for maybe a couple of years. 34 years later, I finally left.
But you haven't really left, have you? Because you've got a very important role here. And how many people are you supporting at the moment?
We look after about 53,000 people last year. We spent £21 million doing that. But that's not good enough, because we know there's a lot more people out there.
And presumably, you want friends and family to know about this too, because often perhaps people are shy or proud and don't actually want to ask for help, or indeed just simply don't know that they are eligible for help.
Well, we're focusing this campaign on the elderly, really, particularly those who are national servicemen and particularly those who are Second World War. We know from our research there's about 1.4 million people in the RAF family. We call the RAF family the veterans, the, as I say, the dependents, the currently serving folk. By 2030, that 1.4 million will have gone down to about a million because of old age and the natural course of events. So we want to get to those elderly people and to reach those elderly people to give them the best possible ending to their lives as we can, because they deserve it. The Benevolent Fund last year, the youngest person we helped was a two-week-old baby in a special hospital. And we helped her serving mum and dad, serving corporal, to be near the child. They needed hotel accommodation, they needed transport and so on and so forth. Our job was to enable them to be near their little two-week-old baby. At the other end of the spectrum, the oldest person I think we helped was a 102-year-old widow. And she was about to be evicted from her home. Now, that's not going to happen on our watch. We're not going to let that happen. And everything in between. All sorts of people, because they're part of the family. Every family comes in shapes and sizes and ages and all the rest of it. And we don't care how old or how young you are. If you're part of the RAF family, we'll look after you. I'm reminded of a gentleman that I worked with years ago. We were in Bosnia, and it was quite a tough tour, and we were dealing with ethnic cleansing. And whilst we were doing that, it was very distressing, and we dealt with some issues around children that had been killed and had been burned. I didn't realise that one of the men I was working with, he'd lost his own child the previous year in a house fire. So to come across burning children was very difficult. As a result of that, he had a mental breakdown, and I had to get him back to the UK in a hurry. That was back in the 90s. got him back to the UK, and he, whatever happened to him is whatever happened to him. Years later, i.e. about a week after I started here at the Benevolent Fund 3 years ago, I was visiting a respite home where we look after people and people go for a break. And lo and behold, there was that gentleman. And that gentleman, I said to him, well, tell me what happened to you when you got back, what happened to your life story, and why are you here today? And he said when he came back from Bosnia, his wife left him because he'd had a mental breakdown and it was all got very, and he'd lost a child and it was very difficult for them. She left him, but he was an honourable man. So he decided to give the house that they owned to her and to give all the money to her because he had another 15 years left in the Air Force where he could rebuild his life again. That's what he decided to do. Unfortunately, 5 years later, he contracted MS. So he had to leave the Air Force without any money, without a house, nowhere to go. So we stepped in and we bought him a house because he didn't have a future otherwise. I asked him what then happened, and he said, well, I'm here this week in the respite home because I've got worse, a lot worse in terms of my physical ability. So you're back in the house this week and you're refurbishing it again for me, widening the doors, putting a wet room in, refurbishing the wet room, and so on and so forth. And I said to him, okay, so you've lost, well, tell me, where are you in your life now? He said, well, I've lost my wife. I've lost my family. He said, I've lost the job that I loved. I've lost my mates because they're all in the Air Force. He said, I've lost everything. He said, you, the RAF Benevolent Fund, have given me back the one thing that I really need, which is my dignity, as well as a house and somewhere to live. And he said, and if it wasn't for you looking after me, he said, I don't know where I'd be. Now, I'm still in touch with that chap because it's personal for me. But that's what sort of thing that we do. And there was nothing that we wouldn't do for him because he did so much for our country and he's part of our family.
Family is such a strong word here, isn't it?
It is. We're at the heart of the RAF family. We're being 100 years old, with the old RAF's oldest friend in many ways.
We've got to spread the word.
We have to. I think the people who served our country, they deserve our support. Really is as simple as that.
And love.
And love.
We care for them and we want to make sure they know that.
Yeah, but tough love sometimes, actually. Yeah. And being an ex-serviceman myself, I've seen the way that people can get themselves into bother. And you put your arm around them. Sometimes you've got to be, you know, fairly tough. But at the end of the day, it's getting people back on the straight and narrow. Sometimes it's money. Sometimes it's just reaching out. Sometimes it's just reminding people that they are part of something big, part of something which is good. Many people contact us, I think, because they just want to be recognised as still part of something which is good, part of that family, and they're not forgotten about, which is why we're reaching out to these people who may think they're forgotten about to let them know they're not forgotten about. They're still part of something which is important and is important to them. You know, they look back very fondly on their service time. They look back very fondly on things that they achieved, which is great. And or they might be widows and they look back and to times when they were in a community, when that community looked after them. They're not forgotten about. We want them back in that community.
Funnily enough, one of the things that Alan said, who at 98 is amazingly spry and full of beans, but he did say it was very difficult when he left the RAF because it had been his life for such a long time and suddenly being out in this very different community, he did struggle with. And it would be good for people to know out there that when they leave the RAF, if they do find it difficult, there are people to talk to. And it's not unusual to find it very difficult to go into civilian life.
It is. The vast majority of people who leave the Air Force, they're not mad, bad or sad. They're very good citizens. They've learned a great deal in the service, which they can use in the civilian world. They contribute a great deal. But there are times, and there are individuals, who do struggle. And those are the people that we're reaching out to as a way of just saying thank you to these people. You know, the extra bit because you've done the extra bit.
David, thank you very much. And I wish you all the best with your campaign.
Thank you.
For the past 100 years, the Fund has always been there to support RAF veterans, serving RAF personnel and their families when they've needed us. But now, as we mark our centenary, we're asking for your help to find thousands more RAF veterans who are eligible for our support. Some may not know that they can get help. Others may be too proud to ask. They're under the radar. But we are determined to find them before it's too late. Join the search. Change a life. Next time on All Stations.
Just out of nowhere, there was this humongous explosion, this bang that just rattled me. I felt the vibrations come through the vehicle. The next thing that I remember seeing is just sky, sand, sky, and then vehicle just slamming down on top of me.
Blown up by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan at just 21, the RAF regiment gunner who lost his leg and battled post-traumatic stress disorder, but rebuilt his life to become a champion.